in this edition of the Scientist Podcast, biology's role in climate change research.
The way to really make progress on all of these issues is to understand the mechanisms rather than simply to describe the patterns.
Coming up, we hear about what biological mechanisms are telling scientists about global warming and how laboratories can do their part to reduce waste and energy consumption. Hi, I'm Carrie Grenz, and you're listening to the Scientist Podcast. In the January issue of The Scientist, we look at five ways that global warming is affecting the biosphere, from fruit fly genes to soil decomposers to coral immunity. As F. Stewart Chapin writes in his introduction to the feature, the biosphere can act as a positive feedback on climate change and have some dramatic impacts on global warming. Staff writer Bob Grant spoke with Chapin, who's a professor at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Here's what Chapin had to say about how climate science has changed in recent years.
I think that the main changes in climate science have been sort of a gradual improvement in our confidence about the trends that have been suspected for a long time. Specifically, we're much more confident now that the globe is warming and that this is caused to a large extent by human activities. So then this focuses our options in terms of future opportunities. The other main thing that I think has happened coincident with this is that the public has become a lot more aware of the changes in climate and of the potential negative consequences of this. So it seems like we're sort of at a really critical moment where both the science is as convincing as it ever has been about the role of human activities in driving changes in climate, and the public is more receptive than it ever has been about actually taking actions to reverse these trends.
So it seems like a big part of doing just that, convincing people that it's occurring and that it's a major problem, involves more physical or atmospheric sciences. Can you talk about how biological sciences can play a role in that somehow, or how that needs to progress as we go forward?
There's two large ways in which ecology and the biological sciences play into these issues of climate change. One is through an improved understanding of the nature of climate feedbacks and the role that ecosystems play in these climate feedbacks. For example, now it's clear that both the oceans and the land are being progressively less and less effective in removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So the ecosystem feedbacks are less effective in compensating for the fossil fuel emissions that people are doing. So we need to understand more about these ecosystem feedbacks, and especially the interactions among carbon feedbacks, changes in the water budget, and changes in the energy budget, because all of these feedbacks interact and affect the interaction between ecosystems and climate. So that's an important area where we realize that now that it's a lot more complicated than simply sequestering carbon in ecosystems. There's other interactions that are important here. Mm-hmm. Then the second way that I could, major way in which I could see biology playing into the climate feedbacks is recognizing the important societal consequences of the ecological changes that are occurring, because ultimately it's human decisions in response to these ecological changes that are going to have the greatest potential to modify the magnitude of these climate feedbacks. And so understanding and communicating more effectively these climate feedbacks and their effects on society, I think, are really crucial in terms of having society take action on things that are happening.
And how about smaller scale biological sciences? Some of the pieces that we'll be running in our January article involve genetic change in certain organisms under conditions of climate change. Do you think that's important as sort of a monitoring tool to see exactly how the biosphere is being affected with our changing climate?
Yes, it seems like the way to really make progress on all of these issues is to understand the mechanisms rather than simply to describe the patterns. Mm-hmm. And some of the important mechanisms include changes in the sensitivity of organisms, changes in the distribution of organisms, which involve genetic changes involve migration of organisms to new locations. So those are really important. We also need to understand fine-scale mechanisms such as changes in competitive balance among different plants that may influence both carbon sequestration and energy exchange with the atmosphere. As all of these fine-scale mechanisms come into play, in the same way, we need to understand the changes in the microbial populations that might influence patterns of decomposition and therefore either carbon sequestration or release back to the atmosphere.
Mm. And do you see a way for researchers to sort of marry the physical and atmospheric sciences with looking at these mechanistic aspects of climate change? I mean, can we in some way incorporate that research into a concerted effort? Because it seems up until now those two lines of inquiry have been sort of disjunct.
I think there's increasing opportunities that depend to a large extent on effective communication among scientists that are looking at climate change at different scales. So, for example, a lot of the climate simulations have until recently just assumed that the biosphere is a constant, and so they focus primarily on the surface-atmosphere interactions. And yet now we know that competition among plants, migration of plants, and strongly influences the nature of the surface. So we need to understand the mechanisms of genetic changes and distribution changes if we're going to understand the feedbacks. And so, but then understanding those details at a really fine scale is much more complex than is currently feasible to include in the climate models. And so there needs to be communication about what the really major effects are of fine-scale mechanisms that can be incorporated at a coarser scale in the climate models. Mm. And conversely, the changes in climate that are predicted by or projected by the climate models need to be translated into those environmental effects that actually impact organisms. So this may be changes in soil moisture, changes in the date of snowmelt, changes in wind speeds and frequency of storms. These may be the really important climatic events for the biologists. And so being able to communicate across scales is really important, and having mutual respect for the importance of processes that are being studied at different scales is equally important.
Mm. And do you feel that those sort of lines of communication are open at present, or do we have some work to do in opening those?
I think the communication is continuing to improve for several reasons. First of all, there's been a huge amount of communication that's been part of the climate change assessment processes through IPCC, through the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, and through the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment. And second of all, some of the most exciting changes that happen at any one of these in any one of these components of science is happening because people are aware of things that are going on at other scales, and they're incorporating those other scales in their own research. Mm. And so this innovation and openness of some individual scientists to things that are being discovered at other scales leads to innovation in each of these scientific communities.
Mm. So if there was one sort of crystallized idea that regarding the biosphere and the effect of climate change on the biosphere that you could impress upon people in the IPCC or people researching climate change from a more physical viewpoint, what would that singular message be?
Good question. Perhaps the most important thing that climate change scientists need to realize is that the biosphere is becoming increasingly out of equilibrium with the climate system. And so many of the changes that will occur in the biosphere are not going to be simple extrapolations of known relationships of climate to biology, so that rather than having a simple linear or curvilinear response of carbon sequestration to temperature, there may be large threshold changes in disturbance regime, in the distribution of biota that could cause surprises. And so I think we need to look much more carefully at the non-equilibrium responses of the biosphere, many of which will be mediated by decisions that people make and the effects of people on ecosystems.
Mm. Let's talk about those decisions. Obviously, there's a huge meeting going on in Bali, Indonesia, right now. How do you think? Well, I guess how is that meeting going in your view? And how could the people who are there discussing human action on climate change benefit from some of the scientific changes that we've talked about?
I think perhaps the way in which that meeting could make most effective use of recent changes in science is by increasing the communication that occurs between natural science and social science. Yeah. Climate change has been largely viewed as a physical science problem, and now I think the physical scientists realize that you can't do the climate projections without incorporating biology. And it's even more important, I think, that both climate change science, that both physical scientists and biological scientists realize that societal decisions have a crucial effect on the distribution of organisms, the frequency of disturbance, and therefore the nature of the biology which affects the climate system. So I think increasing incorporation of social sciences into the cause and effect mechanisms that are considered in climate change science is going to be a really important way forward. And the sorts of issues that need to be considered, especially by policymakers that are looking to make changes in the climate feedbacks, because those can only be accomplished through changes in human decisions.
Mm. I think that brings us nicely to your research. I know that you've looked into the sort of socio-ecological impacts of climate change. Can you just talk briefly about what you're finding and sort of how your research might inform policy in a constructive way?
Some of the things that we've been exploring in Alaska are the effects of climate change on wildfire, for example, and the effect of this on individual communities. And it has huge effects on the subsistence opportunities for local communities. And these subsistence opportunities are a very important part of the cultural identity and the cultural tie that people have to the lands. And therefore, the way in which they interact with the land in terms of disturbances, in terms of migration patterns between rural communities and cities. And this is just a microcosm of the kinds of changes that are happening everywhere in the world, where changes in climate alter the way in which people interact with the lands around them, alter their sense of identity, of who they are, how they relate to the land around them, and therefore the care with which they interact with the land, or basically leave the land and move to cities in search of other economic opportunities. And so thinking about these sorts of connections between climate, people, interactions with the land, and human migration is going to be an important part of the story of how things change in the future.
Mm. So I think this is a good place to end, and I'm curious to hear from you. I mean, we're at a point now where the original Kyoto Protocol has expired, and people are actually trying to, you know, hash out something new in Bali as we speak. So, I mean, are you, as someone who's looked into this issue and made a career out of it, are you hopeful as we go forward here that some sort of resolution is going to be reached and we're going to be able to do something about climate change and its effect on us and the rest of the living things on Earth?
I have to be hopeful. Things continue in the way that they have in the past, I think there's going to be some very, very severe and unexpected changes in in the way society has to deal with the environment in which it lives. And so the only useful way forward is to be hopeful and to look for opportunities to make changes in these systems. So I think we have to be hopeful. We have to be optimistic. We have to look for opportunities that are provided by the changes in science that have happened and the changes in awareness that society shows to the changes that are occurring around them.
Mm. So, I mean, as I see it, as we've been talking, I've sort of been envisioning it as a three-part cycle. I mean, you have policymakers, researchers, and then the public, all involved in this sort of dance. And I'm curious, as one of these researchers, how do you see your role and the role of science in this whole process? I mean, is it most important to get the science? I mean, is there some sort of is it sequential? I don't know if I'm expressing myself clearly, but I mean, it's a part of this process in changing what's going on or trying to affect some change. But where does science really rest in that cycle?
There's so many potential roles for science in the process of change that I think there's opportunities for people to take different types of roles and still be make important contributions. It's important to get the science right. It's hugely important to communicate the science effectively to the general public and to policymakers, which means not only understanding the current status of science, but also being able to communicate that effectively. Mm-hmm. And that's an important place for science to be able to communicate with television and radio audiences, with journals that present scientific information to the general public, and with the policymaking community directly.
That was F. Stewart Chapin at the University of Alaska speaking with staff writer Bob Grant. You can read Chapin's introduction and all the articles on climate change from the January issue at thescientist.com. While you're there, you can check out an article Bob Grant wrote last year about designing green labs. There's a growing trend to build science facilities that are more energy efficient and to minimize their carbon footprints. But there are also things that scientists can do in their existing laboratories to reduce their waste. I asked Mo Tabrizi, the sustainability officer at the University of Colorado in Boulder, about what scientists can do.
You know, laboratories are really important because they're 5 to 7 times more energy intense than the rest of the campus. Laboratories are by far the most intense energy consumption part of the campus compared to academic or your office and my office, obviously. And as such, I think we want to focus on the laboratories. I think one of the key issues in the laboratories is when the equipment are not in use, we create a culture that when the laboratory equipment are not in use, when we're not experimenting, actively collecting data, we go out of our way to turn off those equipment or power manage those equipment. I think that by itself saves tremendous amount of energy and reduces waste. A lot of laboratory equipment are water-cooled, for example, laser generators, and some of the equipment that produces heat. In order to keep the equipment cool, sometimes we use water, running water, meaning potable water, to keep these equipment cool. And we find opportunities to recycle that water or use processed chilled water from our utility power plant to constantly run that water and recycle that water rather than one pass through into the drain. That's an example of water conservation. I think laboratories have a large number of equipment that they could be turned off, or they could be power managed. Autoclaves, sterilizing equipment, they could be put on timers. So when the equipment are needed, the equipment are up and running, and after the equipment and instrumentations have been sterilized, the equipment can go to sleep mode or go to standby mode. Freezers, refrigerators, many of those equipment are old in number of laboratories, and I like to encourage our laboratory managers, when they make purchasing decisions, they buy Energy Star appliances, refrigerators, freezers, and so forth. And the other big issue in the laboratory is the fume hood. When, we condition the air, whether we condition it in the summertime when it's hot out there, we condition it in the wintertime when it's cool out there, bringing it to the lab, and the fume hoods are working, and they need to work when the students are running the experiment or research is being done for the safety of the researchers and students, no question about that. But after the experimentation is completed, we want to see that fume hood sashes are closed, so the air, the conditioned air, is not being just going through the exhaust and going outside the building. In some laboratories, we have heat recovery systems that the exhaust, the BTU or the heat in the exhaust system of these laboratories is being harvested and used as another source of heat for the building. So those are the examples. Some of them are actually no-cost examples, meaning turning the equipment off when they're not in use, or putting the equipment in the standby, or making the right purchasing decision in the next round of equipment for the laboratory.
That was Mo Tabrizi, the Sustainability Officer at the University of Colorado. Get more tips on going green at thescientist.com. Also there, check out the daily news blogs from our writers and editors, see the slideshows from the reporting trips they make, and read all the articles from The Scientist magazine. That's all for The Scientist podcast. Thanks for tuning in.